Fourth story. The jump into the abyss. There was only one trail leading to the flat mesa. Once we were on the mesa itself, I realized that it was not as extensive as it had appeared when I had looked at it from a distance. The vegetation on the mesa was not different from the vegetation below. Faded green woody shrubs that had the ambiguous appearance of trees. At first I didn't see the chasm. It was only when Don Juan led me to it that I became aware that the mesa ended in a precipice. It wasn't really a mesa, but merely the flat top of a good-sized mountain. The mountain was round and eroded on its east and south faces. However, on part of its west and north sides, it seemed to have been cut with a knife. From the edge of the precipice, I was able to see the bottom of the ravine, perhaps 600 feet below. It was covered with the same woody shrubs that grew everywhere. A whole row of small mountains to the south and to the north of that mountaintop gave the clear impression that they had been part of a gigantic canyon, millions of years old, dug out by a no longer existing river. The edges of that canyon had been erased by erosion. At certain points, they had been leveled with the ground. The only portion still intact was the area where I was standing. "It's solid rock," Don Juan said, as if he were reading my thoughts. He pointed with his chin toward the bottom of the ravine. If anything were to fall down from this edge to the bottom, it would get smashed to flakes on the rock down there. This was the initial dialogue between Don Juan and myself that day on that mountaintop. Prior to going there, he had told me that his time on Earth had come to an end. He was leaving on his definitive journey. His statements were devastating to me. A most peculiar interplay between different levels of my awareness took place then. Don Juan, his cohort Don Genaro, two of his apprentices, Pablito and Nestor, and I had climbed to that mountaintop. Pablito, Nestor, and I were there to take care of our last task as apprentices, to jump into an abyss, a most mysterious affair, which Don Juan had explained to me at various levels of awareness, but which has remained an enigma to me to this day. Don Juan jokingly said that I should get my writing pad and start taking notes about our last moments together. He gently poked me in the ribs and assured me, as he hid his laughter, that it would have been only proper, since I had started on the warrior's path by taking notes. Don Genaro cut in and said that other warriors before us had stood on that same flat mountaintop before embarking on their journey to the unknown. Don Juan turned to me and in a soft voice said that soon I would be entering into infinity by the force of my personal power, and that he and Don Genaro were there only to bid me farewell. Don Genaro cut in again and said that I was there also to do the same for them. "Once you have entered into infinity," Don Juan said, "you can't depend on us to bring you back. Your decision is needed then. Only you can decide whether or not to return. I must also warn you that few warriors survive this type of encounter with infinity. Infinity is enticing beyond belief. A warrior finds that to return to the world of disorder, compulsion, noise, and pain is a most unappealing affair. You must know that your decision to stay or to return is not a matter of a reasonable choice, but a matter of intending it. If you choose not to return," he continued, "you will disappear as if the earth had swallowed you. But if you choose to come back, you must tighten your belt and wait like a true warrior until your task, whatever it might be, is finished, either in success or in defeat." A very subtle change began to take place in my awareness then. I started to remember faces of people who I wasn't sure I had met. Strange feelings of anguish and affection started to rise within my being. Don Juan's voice was no longer audible. I was suddenly possessed by the most unbearable love for those persons, whoever they may have been. My feelings for them were beyond words. I sensed their presence, as if I had lived another life before, or as if I were feeling for people I had known in a dream. I sensed that their outside forms shifted. They began by being tall and ended up petite. What was left intact was their essence, the very thing that produced my unbearable longing for them. Don Juan came to my side and said to me, "The agreement was that you remain in the awareness of the daily world." His voice was harsh and authoritative. "Today, you are going to fulfill a concrete task," he went on, "the last link of a long chain, and you must do it in your utmost mood of reason." I'd never heard Don Juan talk to me in that tone of voice. He was a different man at that instant, yet he was thoroughly familiar to me. I meekly obeyed him and went back to the awareness of the world of everyday life. I didn't know that I was doing this, however. To me, it appeared on that day as if I had acquiesced to Don Juan out of fear and respect. Don Juan spoke to me next in the tone I was accustomed to. What he said was also very familiar. He said that the backbone of a warrior is humbleness and efficiency, acting without expecting anything and withstanding anything that lies ahead of him. I went at that point through another shift in my level of awareness. My mind focused on a thought or a feeling of anguish. I knew then that I had made a pact with some people to die with them, and I couldn't remember who they were. I felt, without the shadow of a doubt, that it was wrong that I should die alone. My anguish became unbearable. Don Juan spoke to me. "We are alone," he said. "That's our condition. But to die alone is not to die in loneliness." I took big gulps of air to erase my tension. As I breathed deeply, my mind became clear. "The great issue with us males is our frailty," he went on. "When our awareness begins to grow, it grows like a column, right on the midpoint of our luminous being, from the ground up. That column has to reach a considerable height before we can rely on it. At this time in your life, as a sorcerer, you easily lose your grip on your new awareness. When you do that, you forget everything you have done and seen on the warrior's path, because your consciousness shifts back to the awareness of your everyday life. I have explained to you that the task of every male sorcerer is to reclaim everything he has done and seen on the warrior's path while he was on new levels of awareness. The problem of every male sorcerer is that he easily forgets because his awareness loses its new level and falls to the ground at the drop of a hat." "I understand exactly what you're saying, Don Juan," I said. "Perhaps this is the first time I have come to the full realization of why I forget everything, and why I remember everything later. I have always believed that my shifts were due to a personal condition. I know now why these changes take place. Yet I can't verbalize what I know." "Don't worry about verbalizations," Don Juan said. "You'll verbalize all you want in due time. Today, you must act on your inner silence, on what you know without knowing. You know to perfection what you have to do. But this knowledge is not quite formulated in your thoughts yet." On the level of concrete thoughts or sensations, all I had were vague feelings of knowing something that was not part of my mind. I had, then, the clearest sense of having taken a huge step down. Something seemed to have dropped inside me. It was almost a jolt. I knew that I had entered into another level of awareness at that instant. Don Juan told me then that it is obligatory for a warrior to say goodbye to all the people he leaves behind. He must say his goodbye in a loud and clear voice so that his shout and his feelings will remain forever recorded in those mountains. I hesitated for a long time, not out of bashfulness, but because I didn't know whom to include in my thanks. I had completely internalized the sorcerer's concept that warriors can't owe anything to anyone. Don Juan had drilled a sorcerer's axiom into me. Warriors pay elegantly, generously, and with unequaled ease every favor, every service rendered to them. In this manner, they get rid of the burden of being indebted. I had paid, or I was in the process of paying, everyone who had honored me with their care or concern. I had reviewed my life to such an extent that I had not left a single stone unturned. I truthfully believed in those days that I didn't owe anything to anyone. I expressed my beliefs and hesitation to Don Juan. Don Juan said that I had indeed reviewed my life thoroughly, but he added that I was far from being free of indebtedness. "How about your ghosts?" he went on. "Those you can no longer touch." He knew what he was talking about. During my review of my life, I had recounted to him every incident that I could remember. Out of the hundreds of incidents that I related to him, he had isolated three as samples of indebtedness that I incurred very early in life, and added to that my indebtedness to the person who was instrumental in my meeting him. I had thanked my friend profusely, and I had sensations that something out there acknowledged my thanks. The other three had remained stories from my life, stories of people who had each given me an inconceivable gift, and whom I had never thanked. One of these stories had to do with a man I'd known when I was a child. His name was Mr. Leandro Acosta. He was my grandfather's arch enemy, his true nemesis. My grandfather had accused this man repeatedly of stealing chickens from his chicken farm. The man wasn't a vagrant, but someone who did not have a steady, definite job. He was a maverick of sorts, a gambler, a master of many trades, handyman, self-styled curer, hunter, and provider of plant and insect specimens for local herbalists and curers, and any kind of bird or mammal life for taxidermists or pet shops. People believed that he made tons of money, but that he couldn't keep it or invest it. His detractors and friends alike believed that he could have established the most prosperous business in the area, doing what he knew best, searching for plants and hunting animals, but that he was cursed with a strange disease of the spirit that made him restless, incapable of tending to anything for any length of time. One day, while I was taking a stroll on the edge of my grandfather's farm, I noticed that someone was watching me from between the thick bushes at the forest's edge. It was Mr. Acosta. He was squatting inside the bushes of the jungle itself, and would have been totally out of sight had it not been for my sharp, 8-year-old eyes. No wonder my grandfather thinks that he comes to steal chickens, I thought. I believed that no one else but me could have noticed him. He was utterly concealed by his motionlessness. I had caught the difference between the bushes and his silhouette by feeling rather than sight. I approached him. The fact that people rejected him so viciously, or liked him so passionately, intrigued me no end. "What are you doing there, Mr. Acosta?" I asked, daringly. "I'm taking a shit while I look at your grandfather's farm," he said, "so you better scram before I get up unless you like the smell of shit." I moved away a short distance. I wanted to know if he was really doing what he was claiming. He was. He got up. I thought he was going to leave the bush and come onto my grandfather's land and perhaps walk across to the road, but he didn't. He began to walk inward, into the jungle. "Hey! Hey, Mr. Acosta!" I yelled. "Can I come with you?" I noticed that he had stopped walking. It was again more a feeling than an actual sight because the bush was so thick. "You can certainly come with me if you can find an entry into the bush," he said. That wasn't difficult for me. In my hours of idleness, I had marked an entry into the bush with a good-sized rock. I had found out through an endless process of trial and error that there was a crawling space there, which if I followed for 3 or 4 yards, turned into an actual trail on which I could stand up and walk. Mr. Acosta came to me and said, "Bravo, kid, you've done it. Yes, come with me if you want to." That was the beginning of my association with Mr. Leandro Acosta. We went on daily hunting expeditions. Our association became so obvious, since I was gone from the house from dawn to sunset without anybody ever knowing where I went, that finally my grandfather admonished me severely. "You must select your acquaintances," he said, "or you will end up being like them. I will not tolerate this man affecting you in any way imaginable. He could certainly transmit to you his elan, yes, and he could also influence your mind to be just like his, useless. I'm telling you, if you don't put an end to this, I will. I'll send the authorities after him on charges of stealing my chickens, because you know damn well that he comes every day and steals them." I tried to show my grandfather the absurdity of his charges. Mr. Acosta didn't have to steal chickens. He had the vastness of that jungle at his command. He could have drawn from that jungle anything he wanted. But my arguments infuriated my grandfather even more. I realized then that my grandfather secretly envied Mr. Acosta's freedom. And Mr. Acosta was transformed for me by this realization from a nice hunter into the ultimate expression of what is at the same time both forbidden and desired. I attempted to curtail my encounters with Mr. Acosta, but the lure was just too overwhelming for me. Then, one day, Mr. Acosta and 3 of his friends proposed that I do something that Mr. Acosta had never done before: catch a vulture alive, uninjured. He explained to me that the vultures of the area, which were enormous, with a 5 to 6 foot wingspan, had 7 different types of flesh in their bodies, and each one of those 7 types served a specific curative purpose. He said that the desired state was that the vulture's body not be injured. The vulture had to be killed by tranquilizer, not by violence. It was easy to shoot it, but in that case, the meat lost its curative value. So the art was to catch it alive, a thing that he had never done. He had figured out, though, that with my help and the help of his three friends, he had the problem licked. He assured me that his was a natural conclusion arrived at after hundreds of occasions on which he had observed the behavior of vultures. "We need a dead donkey in order to perform this feat, something which we have," he declared ebulliently. He looked at me, waiting for me to ask the question of what would be done with the dead donkey. Since the question was not asked, he proceeded. "We remove the intestines and we put some sticks in there to keep the roundness of the belly. The leader of the turkey vultures is the king. He is the biggest, the most intelligent," he went on. "No sharper eyes exist. That's what makes him a king. He'll be the one who will spot the dead donkey and the first who will land on it. He'll land downwind from the donkey to really smell that it is dead. The intestines and soft organs that we are going to draw out of the donkey's belly will pile by his rear end, outside. This way it looks like a wildcat has already eaten some of it. Then, lazily, the vulture will come closer to the donkey. He'll take his time. He'll come hopping, flying. And then he will land on the dead donkey's hip and begin to rock the donkey's body. He would turn it over if it were not for the four sticks that we will stake into the ground as part of the armature. He'll stand on the hip for a while. That will be the clue for other vultures to come and land there in the vicinity. Only when he has three or four of his companions down with him will the king vulture begin his work." "And what is my role in all this, Mr. Acosta?" I asked. "You hide inside the donkey," he said with a deadpan expression. "Nothing to it. I give you a pair of specially designed leather gloves, and you sit there and wait until the king turkey vulture rips the anus of the dead donkey open with his enormous powerful beak and sticks his head in to begin eating. Then you grab him by the neck with both hands and don't let go. My three friends and I will be hiding on horseback in a deep ravine. I'll be watching the operation with binoculars. When I see that you have grabbed the king vulture by the neck, we'll come at full gallop and throw ourselves on top of the vulture and subdue him." "Can you subdue that vulture, Mr. Acosta?" I asked him. Not that I doubted his skill, I just wanted to be reassured. "Of course I can," he said with all the confidence in the world. "We're all going to be wearing gloves and leather leggings. The vulture's talons are quite powerful. They could break a shin bone like a twig." There was no way out for me. I was caught, nailed by an exorbitant excitation. My admiration for Mr. Leandro Acosta knew no limits at that moment. I saw him as a true hunter, resourceful, cunning, knowledgeable. "Okay, let's do it then," I said. "That's my boy," said Mr. Acosta. "I expected as much from you."